white tail movement is extremely restrictive when you're comparing it to a mule deer. You know, so I mean, they're obviously in the velvet season. They're not as in thick a cover because of that velvet. So you'll find them out on the, you know, more of the barren hillsides of the country. You're finding them in a lot more often. That November hunt, it's tough. I mean, guys that are, if you're in a good population unit, you know, you will probably fare well. If you're in a low density unit, like, 30B, I would consider to be kind of a low density coos unit. I've started to pay attention to a lot of the harvest reporting. I've seen that's, you know, has become a big tool for me on the guiding side. I mean, it's stuff that I would have never looked at, you know, from the personal aspect of just hunting. I'd have just went out, tried to find my deer and hunted. But, you know, from the guiding perspective, that's a pretty heavy-handed document.
The does always get first choice of habitat over the bucks because they have children, you know, whatever. So the bucks always give the does first choice. So the does pick the primest habitat to live in, and then the bucks choose, you know, according to what's left over and what's going to keep them most secure. Hey guys, before we get into this next episode, I want to share a couple things with you. First, I am happy to announce the new daysinthewild.com is finally launched. Everything is in one place: my guide services, the podcasts, access to my blogs, etc. So go check it out, daysinthewild.com. If you've been following the show lately, you know that we've partnered with Bushnell and Primos. The awesome thing about that is that if you use promo code STL02, STL02, you will save 15% on anything they sell. It doesn't have to be the stuff that I use. I've been using the Bushnell trail cameras for years. I did a couple of reviews over the years, and Bushnell always came out on top. They're excellent. And I know you've heard me talk about Primo's calls and how good they are, but I've also been using their ground blinds, and they're awesome. I don't know if you remember Double Bull blinds, but that's a Primo's product now, or has been for a while. I also tried out a set of their shooting sticks, and for standing shots, or, you know, using for clients when we're predator hunting, or my kids that need it when we're spot and stalk and have to get in close on javelina or anything like that. It's like a really good tool. I love them. They're quick setup and they're steady. Lastly, do yourself a favor and go check out the lineup of shooting bags, glassing pads, and other accessories that Phoenix Shooting Bags puts out. Go to phoenixshootingbags.com, use promo code John Stallone, all one word, and save 20%. Rifle season is upon us, guys. You'll thank me later, I promise. Go check them out. Hey, don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It helps me keep bringing you guys content for free. It definitely helps out our ratings and reach more people. So thanks again for taking care of that. Appreciate it. Now let's roll into this next episode. Hi, welcome to Days in the Wild, Big Game Hunting Podcast. Today we're going to talk coos deer with my good buddy, Eddie Willie. What's up, man?
What's up, man? How you doing?
I'm good. Good. No major complaints. About to leave for South Dakota, so I'm cramming a couple of these in so I could leave without worrying about the podcast, you know, among other million other things I got to do. But I got two tags in South Dakota this year. I drew a reservation tag as well. So I'm going to try to fill my public or my statewide archery tag. And then if I fill that, I'm going to go hunt on the res.
Nice.
Yeah. The only thing about hunting on the res is I got to get a guide. You're not allowed to hunt. Yeah. You're not allowed to hunt by yourself, but it's still, I mean, freaking, it's awesome. Big ass. Well, yeah. Big ass bucks. You got a tag in your pocket. Yeah. Right. The big ass bucks on the reservation too. So anyway, we'll see how it goes. I know it's cold as shit up there right now. I just checked the weather in the 10-day forecast. The high is 25. So,
oh gosh,
yeah, I'm not ready for it. Since we're like what, still like 85, 90 degrees?
Yeah, man. I know. I mean, if you'd have done this a couple of weeks ago, you'd have been good.
Oh man,
you know.
Yeah,
we had that cold snap. It at least prepped you a little bit. Now it's back to being hot as heck.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know. This Arizona boy right here is gonna freeze his nuts off for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I know you've been on the show a few times already, but just to give me a quick rundown of who you are, just in case those tuning in didn't catch your first couple episodes. So,
all right. Eddie Willie, obviously. I'm located down here in southeastern Arizona, down here by Sierra Vista, Arizona, and then owner operator of Southeastern Arizona Outfitters. Been an Arizona guy, went in the military, did a career in the military, ended up back here my last, I don't know, 6 years in the military, and retired and decided to live my best life and start up an outfitting business, and been going strong ever since.
Nice. So you know, we are going to talk a little bit about the different seasons in Arizona.
Okay.
Get into some tactics and how the deer might act a little different from one time period to the next. So, Even though we've already passed the early archery, that was back in August, and you know, here we are it's election day today, actually.
Yeah.
Trump 2020.
Yeah. Nation on its toes.
I know, man. Oh my God. I'm so worried about the outcome no matter what. I think we're in for a doozy. But
yeah.
Anyway, I don't want to get into politics. So let's talk about the early archery. What, describe to me, you know, what somebody who's never been here on that hunt, what they would expect that hunt to be like, and your typical deer behavior during that hunt.
Okay.
And then we'll get into some tactics on how you're hunting them that time of year.
Yeah. So, the units and the stuff that I kind of hunt and run clients through, I mean, obviously, you know, it's going to be warm. So, I mean, you can expect, you know, some temperatures are going to be 90 to probably 110 degrees. We hunt a lot of stuff between, right around 4,000 feet to 7,000 feet. The early hunt, I'm a big spot and stock guy. Here recently I've started taking on some older clientele and guys, a lot more out of state clients. So they're a lot more accustomed to kind of sit in deer stands or sitting in blinds. So this past year, I've done probably more blind hunting than I have ever, which is a difficult thing for me being a guide, because, you know, I feel when I'm out doing spot and stock, I'm putting glass on hillsides and stuff like that, that I'm doing work.
Yeah, well, people could see the work that you're doing when you're doing blind hunting and you're doing stand hunting. All the work goes into before they get there. You're checking trail cameras, you know, checking water tanks, running licks, doing this, running around. Yeah. All kinds of.
And it's a hard one for me, man. I'm not gonna sit here and BS anybody that's hunted with me and has brought up blind hunting or stand hunting. I've up until this year, I've kind of really tried to fringe away from it, I guess, if you will, a little bit. I've done it, obviously. I've hunted back east a ton, being in the military, and killed a ton of deer out of more deer stands than anything. But it's just kind of my tactics and techniques. You know, sitting water is one thing. I don't, you know, I do put salts out in cameras and stuff like that, and I don't really hunt over salts. But, you know, and sitting water, you know, I'll be honest with you, in the past, I've kind of felt in a sense it was, I don't want to say a cop out, but it's just, you know, obviously you have to watch these water holes and you got to catalog what's coming in, you know, to just put it simply, I didn't feel I was working for the client. For me to go sit water, I could do it because, you know, if I was sore from hiking 15 miles in 3 days or a couple of days, you know, I could go sit water and know, you know, what's using it and use it as kind of a down day. But guiding wise, it's just been a struggle for me. But I know, obviously, I mean, I killed a great buck this year off of water, you know, so I know it's successful.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a good tactic.
Especially when you have a year like this. This was the year to sit on water.
Yeah, dude, it was looking at Facebook, man, people were just thumping stuff left and right, and good bucks on water. Yeah. So, you know, it really played well to it.
They were very tied to water. You ever get, when you get a year like this, shitty monsoon season, and, you know, the feed's just not giving them water that they need, they're watering every day. They have to.
Yep, you're right. You know, so, but naturally, by nature, on the guiding side, and even my hunting, my personal hunting techniques, I'm a big spot and stock guy. So, you know, you want a guy, my clients, you know, I send them like a little welcome letter, letting them kind of know what the temperatures are going to be roughly on average, and then, you know, kind of a gear list to run, and then, you know, the terrain that we're going to cover. And, you know, with that over-the-counter tag being, you know, that archery tag, you know, you have the freedom of movement. You don't have to be as particular when you're putting a guy in for a rifle tag. So
right.
I really let kind of what that client's looking for dictate what we're going to hunt, which can kind of be a little, there's a little game to be played there, and being able to kind of really pulse your clients as far as what their capabilities are. Because you don't want to take them over the top, and some of the stuff I hunt's extremely rugged. I mean, some of the stuff we horseback into. So you just kind of really got to be able to pulse your client, and doing that and having that over the counter tag kind of gives you the freedom of movement to be able to do a bunch of different things, which I mean, obviously I enjoy, and it bids well on the guiding side. So yeah, I mean, I want them in shape, and I'm kind of giving them a kind of telling them what I need them to be doing as far as their shooting capability. You know, I like them to be able to shoot out to 70 yards and feel that they're fairly accurate at that distance. And obviously we try and work shots in under that. But, you know, I need them confident. I need them to be confident to take a shot out to 70, especially when you're starting to talk mule deer, where you can take those shots. Coos deer, obviously, I'm extremely hesitant to take a shot that long. But, yeah, so there's quite a bit of stuff that you're pumping into them, and the earlier you can get them booked, or the earlier, you know, like I when I'm hunting for myself, I've got a pretty good general idea of where I want to go. I've got some favorite places I like to pop into to kind of get away from the madness and hunt kind of out and by myself, you know.
So what are you, let's talk about the spot and stalk hunting. How's your glassing technique? What are you doing in the early season to turn up bucks? Where are you finding them?
Still early season, so on the whitetail side. So, you know, whitetail movement is extremely restrictive when you're comparing it to a mule deer. You know, so, I mean, they're obviously in the velvet season. They're not as in thick a cover because of that velvet. So you'll find them out on the, you know, more of the barren hillsides of the country. You're finding them in a lot more often. You're glassing, you know, you're scouting. I get a lot of, I run quite a few trail cameras, so I see a lot of stuff and a lot of nighttime stuff on trail cameras, unless I have it on a spring or something. But, you know, a lot of movement at the night, you know, during the nocturnal portions. But I find myself, so I've got a couple different optic setups that I run. So I have some Kawa big eyes. And then I got, you know, my 1556s, my spotting scopes, stuff like that. So I do a lot of stuff with Kawas. I try not to really push into their country as much, unless I'm going to go in and kind of, you know, put some salt out, or, you know, I really got to check cameras. And even with my cameras, they're more bordering areas. So, you know, looking at a buck, you know, or a batch or group of bucks that I'm watching that are running like a three canyon set, I won't really get deep into the canyons. I'll run a lot of stuff on ridgelines, travel corridors, so I'm not really being intrusive when I'm running my cameras. If I get on something, you know, kind of world class, in a sense, you know, I'm jumping up in the high 120 and 30 brackets, which we've done in the past, I'll get a little bit more intrusive, but it's just a lot more, there's a lot more strategy played because their range doesn't seem to be as big.
The bigger the buck, the smaller the range.
The smaller the range is what it seems like. Now that doesn't always hold true, but for the most part, what I've seen, it does for sure. But what I'll end up doing is I'll take my cameras and I'll grid them. I'll box them in. So I'll put a camera and I'll get it on. You know, they kind of have what I call like a community ridge, you know, between different groups of or different herds of bucks that are running stuff. So once I find that buck, I'll jump a ridge over and let it run for a month or two and see if I can catch him on that ridge line. If I don't, then I bounce in and I basically start closing my cameras in on that buck until I start out big mass area, you know, and then I just, you know, I start just basically closing the box. And then when I get him on camera, I'll stop that camera and then I'll start closing in others until I basically box him in. And then I got, you know, at that point, I have a really solid idea where that buck is running. That strategy works extremely well for my rifle seasons. It doesn't work so well for archery seasons or the
because rut. They're not going to a specific destination, but you know what hillside they're going to come out on. And if you know what hillside exactly. they're going to come out with a rifle, obviously you can.
You got them.
Yeah.
You know, but, and then the thing is, you know, kind of where them bucks are at in the velvet isn't, they don't frequent that area as often. They'll still hit it, but they don't hit it as often as they do once they've stripped that velvet down. You know, they're more in an open country setting during the velvet. And then when that gun season starts hitting, you know, they're obviously in a lot thicker cover, you know, and you're a lot more reliant upon your camera sets as far as where that buck, where you really need to be putting time and effort in to find that deer.
Right. Well, let's move to that first rifle season. The first rifle season usually hits what,
last week of October.
20-something of October, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, by now, most of the deer, sometimes you get a couple still in velvet in their first couple days, but most of the deer have stripped. And I feel that right after, especially opening weekend, but even after the first 2 days, like the first day even, whatever pattern they were on goes out the window. What are you seeing?
So that's my favorite hunt. So that first hunt, outside of the youth hunt.
Yeah, the youth hunt is the best.
Is epic.
Yeah, because right? it's all the benefits of the archery season, yes. And you got a gun in your hand.
and low
tag numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Right, it's the Kayabab tags of coos deer hunting.
Right,
but yeah, so that first hunt is my favorite hunt. It is your, in my opinion, it is your best opportunity to get after the deer that you've got pattern, who's going to be in that pattern. If he's in a bachelor group, you've got probably an 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 chance of him, you know, still hanging with that bachelor group. So if you can't find him and you can find the bucks that he's running with, you should have in the back of your mind, you know, you should have a ton of confidence that you just got to put glass on in the brush and get him located. And it's probably one of the only hunts that you'll find him really, you know, especially an older buck, that you're going to find him up on his feet during the daylight doing what he's been doing for, you know, half the year. So that, you know, you jump into those 3 days of the first hunt. You know, you get in, you know, Monday, that season starts on a Friday, that Monday, your big buck, if he's seen any pressure at all, in my opinion, what ends up happening is, you know, I hear tons of people and the guys that I, you know, the clients I hunt and the guys I hang around with, my other guides, you know, we talk about it often and I just go stir crazy because I'll see posts on Facebook or I'll talk to hunters in the general area and they're like, yeah, dude, I seen a 100-inch buck in here. I've been watching him and I get in here and he's just blown out of here. And I'm sure, I'm not going to say that that doesn't happen, but the amount of pressure it would take for a coos deer to blow out of country, in my opinion, and the experience that I have hunting these things would have to be astronomical. What ends up happening is that buck, in my opinion, 9 times out of 10 just goes nocturnal. So, you know, you have to have confidence in all that work you've done up to that point, you know, and I just see so many people just kind of throw that work out the window and, you know, you just, those deer are there. The deer that you're hunting is there. You just, what the difference is you're not going to find him standing. You're going to have to find him and laid up underneath, you know, an oak tree, a juniper, up in some buck brush, some cat claw. You're going to have to change your glassing habit, going from looking at a silhouette to trying to find an ear flick, you know, or a head turn or the shine of a tine or something up in some deep cover.
Now, have you found this to be true? I don't see it every year, but, and maybe because I don't put the time in that as much time in every year, but I also find that after that pressure hits the first initial couple of days, that you'll actually see them as long as it's not hot. Because we can, like this year, we had a really friggin' hot October. Last year, we didn't. Last year was nice and cool. So last year, I would start seeing bucks again after 10:30, closer to 11 o'clock in the morning. And those were when I would see those bucks that you didn't see in the morning hours. I feel like they just kind of like, all right, well, most of the pressure is between, you know, 6:30 a.m. and 10 a.m. And then again from, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock to, you know, dark. So they're like, I'm going to check out. I'm going to punch out. And the other time, so at nighttime and in the middle of the day, they seem to be more active.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, and I guess you could look at it a couple different ways, and I can't say that it's one thing or the other or a combination of a bunch of stuff. I know there was a year that I hunted coos up north, and I seen a ton of predator sign in there, probably the most predator sign I ever seen. And I could not find a deer for the first 2 hours of light and the last 2 hours of light. But I could sit there from 9 o'clock to 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. It just looked like cockroaches. There were so many deer moving. And the only thing that I could contribute it to, because it was just way out of the norm to see that much movement. But the only thing I could attribute it to was the amount of pressure. There was a lot of lions in that country that year. And the only thing I can contribute it to is just the amount of, you know, predator pressure that they were feeling. You know, I do see bucks, like you're saying, you know, that 10 to 2. I know, you know, whitetail are pretty established that they'll water at that time in certain locations. I've seen them water, of course, at, you know, daybreak and right at dusk. And, but I was telling you, blind hunting, I sit a water hole that I hadn't sit since I was a kid, this past year. And I made it like a little camping event with my youngest daughter who drew a tag and just trying to make a fun, you know, outing with her. And we camped up in the mountains, and I said, hey, all we're going to do, we're not going around and do no glassing. I'm going to have you bring your tablet. We'll bring some cards. And I sit in a water hole. And we had 16, I think it was 18 coos deer come in, and I had 6 bucks come in. And from, it was around 8:30 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I've never seen that much movement on a water hole. And, it, you know, a lot of that may be because I just don't sit them. But I know. Well,
we had that super year. This was a perfect year for it.
Right.
Like, honestly.
Right. It was. You're absolutely right. But I know in the past, like you're saying, I've seen deer, coos deer are pretty notorious for getting up and moving, you know, doing a midday browse, if you will. You know, it's not that I think they're moving bedding positions and whatnot. I think it can be contributed to maybe a moon phase or, you know, what the weather's doing. But you're right. I mean, we've killed quite a few bucks between 10 and 2. And they're moving, you know, parallel on a mountain or even up a mountain, not necessarily down a mountain to water.
So let's talk a little bit about the next season, the early November
hunt,
which to me is my least favorite hunt that we have.
I would agree with you. I would, well, I won't say 100%, but I think the worst one for me is the rut. But
okay. Well, for targeting bucks, I think it's the worst. Like if you have a specific buck you want to go after, I think the rut's the worst, but
Yeah. I would agree with you. Yeah. And that's where I'm coming from. But yeah, that November hunt, it's tough. I mean, guys that are if you're in a good population unit, you know, you will probably fare well. If you're in a low density unit, like, 30B, I would consider to be kind of a low density coos unit. It's obviously got coos deer and it's got good coos deer in it, but we have an astronomical amount of tags that come in for coos deer down here. And I would say we fringe on holding the numbers to market that amount of tags. And it's a tough hunt. I mean, I have a client that's coming in for this next hunt. And, you know, there's just going to be a high expectation. I've been communicating with him, you know, throughout the year that, you know, we're going to put some miles, you know, getting back in and away from what I feel are the high pressure areas. It changes from a guiding perspective. It changes some of the stuff that you can hunt in October. You probably don't want to hunt in November. You're going to want to push back, you know, back into the hills to some of the more remote stuff that, you know, you're having to put a couple miles on your boots to get back into and glass and target them deer. You're just going to have a higher probability of success. And it's going to be kind of like hunting a big coos, man. You're going to be putting a ton of glass looking for them guys bedded up. And they're probably at that point almost going to strictly water at night because of the amount of pressure that they felt. But if you're putting some miles on your boots, getting back in 3, 4, or 5 miles, you're going to have a higher chance of success in that November hunt.
Yeah. We have a guy up here in Central Arizona for that hunt. And after what I just saw, because it's the same unit that we had clients in before for the early, I am not really optimistic. You kind of hit it on the head. I think Fish and Game needs to dial back, especially they've been ramping up the coos deer tags. I think honestly they need to cut the tags. I mean, it sucks for us because then we're going to have less clients or whatever, but I think they need to cut the tags quite a bit, if not in half, for at least a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I've started to pay attention to a lot of the harvest reporting. I've seen that's, you know, has become a big tool for me on the guiding side. I mean, it's stuff that I never looked at, you know, from the personal aspect of just hunting. I'd have just went out, tried to find my deer and hunted.
Yep.
But, you know, from the guiding perspective, that's a pretty heavy-handed document.
Right. Yep, for sure.
You know, so, yeah, you just got to push them off. You got to push deep. If you got guys listening, push deep for sure, you know, on those November tags, because it's going to pay a larger dividend, and you're going to work harder in the beginning of your hunt, but you're not going to work as hard throughout your hunt.
Right.
Doing it that way.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. So that brings us to the next hunt, which is, I feel that most people dislike this hunt the most, but I like this hunt. I like that pre-rut hunt, the late November, early December hunt. With a rifle, I've killed my biggest deer, I think, was during that hunt.
Yeah.
I've always done well on that hunt. I like the fact that it's finally cold in Arizona by that time. I don't have to mess with snakes.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But so what's your feeling with on that hunt?
Yes. I'm kind of in the same boat. So I mean, obviously that first hunt's my favorite. I would say this is probably my second favorite hunt. And it's, a lot of it is like you're saying. I mean, the weather's a lot more hospitable. It just seems like, to me, deer have got in a pattern. So I don't, complacent maybe is the best word. So, you know, some of these deer that have survived those first two hunts, you know, obviously they're not invincible, but I think they've got a comfort level or a false sense of security that what they've been doing the first two, you know, the first two go arounds of hunting is working for them. So obviously, you know, if you got that hunt, you want to use that to your capability. Guys that draw that, you just have a lot more from the hunting aspect. You just have a lot more gas tank. You don't have so many things working against you. By then, you know, we start to get a little bit of moisture. Usually, you know, your body isn't fighting the environment like it is in the early hunts. So you got a little bit more gas in the tank to go hard and hunt hard. I'm still a big fan on those hunts to pushing in deep, you know, after your bigger deer. But it's that time of year that you can kind of run a hillside from a truck doing some glassing and stuff and usually catch stuff moving. You know, it's starting to get colder, so there's a shift in the environment that those deer have to get up and feed a lot more often, longer into the day, and they're getting up earlier, you know, because of the temperatures. The only thing that I don't like about that hunt is I love the weather and I hate the weather, because if it's good Arizona weather, you're going to have a great hunt. It's going to be cool. You'll get a little bit of sun on your back, you know, midday to warm the body up, and then it'll get cool and you'll jack it up in the afternoon till it gets dark. But it's those years where you got these, you know, snowstorm that comes in and packs in for 2 days, or you got showers for 2 days on a hunt continuous, or, you know, that.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it always rains on that hunt.
Yeah. And it does to me too.
Honestly, I mean, I don't like hunting in the rain, but nobody does. Nobody likes getting wet, I think. But I like when we get a little bit of inclement weather on that hunt. For some reason, I find that deer move, you know, you'll see more movement, especially if we get a real good cold snap. They're going to be up packing on the feed. And then I also like that last week or the last week, it's 10-day hunt, right? The last few days, 5 days of the hunt, over the first 5 days of the hunt, because I tend to find, and it's not a lot, but you get a decent percentage of the bucks, they start going on that. That hiatus. Yeah. That they'll walk from 3-4 miles across four ridges, you know, whatever, just kind of cruising, quartering into the wind, like, you know, like whitetail dew back east, trying to sniff, you know, a hot doe or whatever. And every once in a while you'll see a little chasing, you'll see a little whatever. I just feel like the activity, you don't get as, like, where we were just talking about that last hunt, they're just bedded down and they're not moving. I feel like just more.
Oh yeah. They're
overall activity.
And I mean, you're going to see, I mean, outside of your early hunt, that early rifle hunt, you're going to, this is the hunt you're going to have the most, you know, in a sense, the most activity. I mean, even the dead heap of the rut, I enjoy it, but I hate it for chasing a target deer. You know, but to guide a client who, you get a guy in that he's, hey, I want to shoot 85 to 100 inches, it's a great hunt. And they're going to see a lot of deer, you know, and they're going to get to be able to pass on deer and feel that they're kind of building into a caliber animal, as opposed to just coming out and, hey, we're just looking for this one particular deer, or, hey, we're going to glass until our eyes bleed. But yeah, I mean, and I think that hunt, you learn a lot on that hunt. You get to watch a lot of behavior, you know, to where a lot of your other hunts, you don't get to see that, because you're just not seeing that amount of deer. I mean, I have found natural salt licks during that time of year that I never even knew they existed, only because of that time of year watching, because you get to watch so many animals. Yeah, it's a good hunt, especially for clients. Yeah,
I agree. And it was actually for a while was my bread and butter, but now there's no more leftover tags.
Yeah, man.
You know.
Yeah, that was just heartbreaking this year.
Yeah, man. I you know what? This year I put in like four people for that hunt during the draw, and they didn't draw.
Yeah, I put five guys.
I was like, and now like that tag goes unsubscribed every year.
Yeah, I mean,
and you didn't draw it.
Yeah, even my clients, I was like, listen, we're going to put in for some high caliber units, big bucks, top end quality stuff. And kind of my methodology was, that's what we'll do. And then if we don't draw, man, we'll pick you up a leftover tag. We'll get you out in Arizona. We'll just do, you know, we'll just get out here and get you a you know, a nice buck or a nice representation of the unit. Heck, man, this year just killed me. And I mean, I all but almost guaranteed the tags, you know, and I had five guys that didn't pick up nothing.
Oh yeah. I had 11 people that didn't draw.
Yeah.
I was freaking floored, man. Yeah. I was like, oh man, it's going to be busy, busy, busy season.
Yep.
I didn't book a lot of stuff for myself, man. I'm going on this is my first hunt really since I went 4 days in August I shot a giant buck.
Yeah, I heard. I seen.
And freaking couldn't find it.
Yep, I seen that. I felt for you. That's a hard pill. It's a pill everybody has to take at some point if you hunt long enough, for sure.
Yeah,
but it's damn sure a hard pill to swallow, bud.
Yeah, I shot him and put him to bed. He didn't go very far. Stalked him again. At the time, I didn't know, but I was 20 yards from him, but I was 45 yards from his buddies, and I just figured he was laying down with them. But at some point, he moved away and got into a different bush, and I was sitting there just baking, you know, August, middle of the day. It was like noon at this point, and I had been sitting there just cooking in the sun for 2 hours. You know, sitting in the same spot on these deer. And I was like, I gotta move. I'm in so much pain. Like, my legs are asleep because I'm sitting on these little, you know, cobble rocks and whatever. So I lean back and I'm like, let me just stretch my back. I lean back and the rock was so hot, it like burnt me. So I popped up quick and one of the little bucks caught my movement, jumped up, he blew, and they all stood up. And I'm like, okay, which one is he? I'm like, I don't see him. I drew back, you know, because I had ranged them up already. I knew they were like 45 yards. I'm like, I drew back and I'm like, then I hear something to my right and he's right there, 20 yards to my right. He was there the whole damn time, 20 yards to my right. I couldn't see him. I wouldn't have been able to see him until he stood up anyway. But, and so I turn and I can't shoot in the seated position. So I roll over on my knees, stand up, still all full draw, and get anchored. I'm just about to shoot him and he bounds off and then he stops. I figured him for like 50 yards, but he must have been closer and I shot right over his back for the second shot. And after that, I couldn't pick him up. And my spotter, my cousin Anthony, was with me in the morning, but he had left me about 2 hours earlier. He had to go to work. So I was out there by myself and of course I lost them. And it was just heartbreaking.
Yep.
Because
it is. Well, I don't get a lot of archery. I mean, I archery hunt every year. I try to, you know, here and there between clients, but I don't get a lot of deer just simply for the fact that, you know, I am doing it myself and, you know, having that spotter, man, it's just,
oh yeah, for sure.
It just increases your odds so much.
So after that day, I got kind of disgusted and I went back out there the next day with my cousin Paul, his brother, and Anthony's brother, and I tried a glass for him to see if I could find him, but I couldn't turn him up. I couldn't find his friends either. So I was hoping, I was like, all right, I'll find the friends and maybe he'll be right there. But no can. And that's after that. I stopped hunting for the Arizona early archery season. I just got disgusted and went home.
Yeah.
Plus my son was giving me a hard time. He's like, oh, crying for me every night. So made it even harder, made it easier for me to leave.
Yeah.
But so anyway, what brings us to the rut season, which is actually my favorite. You said it's not your favorite. It's my favorite just because I love the rut. I love the frenzy. I love the, but the one thing I don't like about it is that the bucks don't stay still long enough for you to kill them sometimes. Right. You'll see a big buck and you're like, oh, okay, there he is. Yeah. And we're making a move. And then all of a sudden that doe decides to go, you know, chase, run him all over the damn place. And now he's out of range again, you know, and it's just, that's the only thing. I've had it happen to me on, I had a tag.
Yeah. It's a great hunt.
2016.
It's a great hunt to guide for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, from the guiding perspective, you're going to see a ton of deer. Hands down, you're just going to see a ton of deer. And, you know, you're going to see a lot of bucks. And for the most part, you're going to see a lot of good, you know.
That middle class.
Yeah. Or, you know, good representation of the unit. I hate to say middle class, low class, high class, you know. Because, you know, everybody has their thing. And just shooting a deer is an accomplishment with a bow.
Right.
But, you know, it's just, you see a lot of good representation of the unit you're hunting during the rut. You know, a lot of them bucks that, you know, you'll see a couple of them, three or four of them during a rifle hunt. But, you know, on that.
They all come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, man. They're just running batshit crazy. And you know, I like to grunt and rattle, and we rattle in a lot of coos deer, and it's fun. It's, you know, from the perspective of you know, me, like my personal ambitions when I hunt is I like to target, you know, I like to target a specific style deer. I will obviously shoot a deer that I feel, you know, has character or whatever. But usually when I run out and hunt, I'm after a particular deer. And it's one of the reasons why I don't kill a lot of deer every year, you know, cause I don't, I mean, I'd love to say that I'm not that guide or hunter, man, that just slams a big buck year after year after year. I'm not. I can glass big bucks and I find big bucks, but when it comes down to the nut cutting of harvesting one, I'm not that guy, you know, so from that perspective, guiding wise, it's a great hunt, man. Guys that come out here, you know, I have a lot of guys that come from back east that come out here and look at this stuff. It's not as action packed in the sense of everything's up close and personal like it is for them back east, but watching a mountain range, and then you get that guy in on a good, you know, on a, you know, like that November, that low November tag, that second hunt, they see a drastic difference between our rut hunt and that tag. They see a lot more animals. So, but I mean, guys kill, there's a lot of great bucks killed during that tag.
Oh, you know, for sure.
Quality bucks, you know, representative bucks of the unit, you know, a lot of 85 to 100 inch deer, which is awesome. Cause that is probably the hunt outside of targeting a specific deer that if you want to come in and just knock down a good representation buck, dude, that's the hunt to do it. And you're going to get a lot of opportunity to do it. Now, I don't like it as much because it's just a damn fiasco, even from the guiding side. Obviously, I've got the country and I know the country. So going in and, you know, you're talking to a client and he's, you know, and I normally send, you know, I normally, when I book a guy for that first hunt, you know, I'm sending them three or four photos of different deer going, hey, man, which one appeals to you? Which one do you think you'd like to go after? And we get after it. I don't do that on that December tag.
Because you can't.
I can't.
The buck that was there all year long.
Yeah, there's no telling.
So now the caveat to that is, so every year, like clockwork, I have certain spots that I know 100% are the rutting grounds.
Yes.
But you can't follow a deer all year long. So like, okay, to give you for instance, I got a big buck down south that I chased for 4 years. Every year, the last couple of days of December, first week of January, he shows up same spot pretty much. Yeah. Okay. I have no freaking clue where this deer is living the rest of the year. I've ran cameras this year. One of my guides actually had the tag. He had the December tag, but he ended up shooting one in August anyway. A really good buck in velvet, so he turned the tag back in. But we were running cameras all the way. We couldn't pick him up anywhere. I don't even know if he's in that same mountain range. Like that's how
bad it is.
I can't find him. 4 years. I mean, I haven't put that much time looking for him in the off season because I always hunt him in January. I always hunt him in December and January. I've only stalked him once myself. Every time I go there, it's with a client. You know, it's right. Like there's been a few times where I'm like, oh my God, I wish that was me because I'd be killing this deer right now. Exactly. So I have that with mule deer and coos deer both. Mm-hmm. I have very specific spots that I know every year, and you'll get it for like 3 years. You'll get that buck, will keep, unless it gets killed, obviously he'll come back to that same spot, and there will always be a couple more other bigger caliber bucks there also.
Right. I noticed that's happened quite.
So you can, but it's not something you can pattern a deer all season long and expect to go back, because 9 times out of 10 where they live pre-rut, before the rut, is not where they're going to be
running. Right.
And that's just it. So like I've always been a big rut hunter down here. That's like my favorite time of year, because most of the other time of the year I was traveling other states, hunting other things. So I always save December, January for my Arizona stuff. you know, for my Arizona deer personally. And I just developed, I have a bunch of spots that are like that. I know that I'm going to go sit on this point, and that buck that I chased last year that I didn't get, he's going to be back in there. If he didn't die, obviously. But
yeah, it's kind of the same way. I mean, like up north, I got big kind of flat top mesas, if you will, that happens that, you know, you'll have deer in a location, but they just seem to frenzy in this one spot, you know, and you could sit there and glass it or kind of get up in there. And I mean, you just literally see like 15 different bucks run through there, you know. And, you know, down here, down south, you know, it's not so much flat tops as much as it is like a canyon, you know, a little finger in a canyon, or that it just seems like just bounce back and forth up and over the top of. And I know from the guiding perspective, that's kind of what I put, you know, that's, I'll try and stage clients up, you know, up on that stuff, you know, waiting for thermals or, you know, that type of stuff to get, you know, get deer killed or, you know, get in and rattle and grunt, you know, within earshot of it to try and draw something down and in, or, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, we had a buck that we watched him and he's a big buck. We watched him and he rutted in his home range pretty hard. What I found is when he got killed, we got him killed on, what was that? It was a November tag. And when they rutted, we ended up getting another, you know, obviously bucks are transitioning out of that area. But we had another nice buck. I mean, obviously not the same caliber.
Come in and fill
That's
a
exactly
slot.
What he did. It's kind of like bass fishing.
Yeah. So this is some research that, and I read this years and years ago about whitetail, and I spoke with Dr. Kroll, Dr. James Kroll, about it, the deer doctor, or Dr. Deer, or whatever he goes by. So the reason for that is that does always get first choice of habitat over the bucks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because they have children, you know, whatever. They, whatever. So the bucks always give the does first choice. So the does pick the primest habitat to live in. And then the bucks choose, you know, according to what's left over and what's going to keep them most secure. So when the rut comes, does are occupying this, you know, very specific habitat. It has all the right things, right? So there's always going to be does there. And there's always going to be a big buck that comes in because those does are there.
And occupant. Okay. Well, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, because, I mean, a doe is going to have everything, food, shelter, water, right?
Right.
Bucks,
exactly.
You know, probably are traveling.
It's the one time the bucks get to enjoy the nicest habitat.
Yeah, the good amenities. Yeah, because, I mean, even my big bucks, I mean, you know, them bucks, you know, they had a small range, but they were pretty fringy compared to what I've seen. What I would have considered optimal habitat, which is what the obvious, and it was a majority of does and young bucks that were coming up that lived in it. So that makes sense. I mean, I can see that. Yeah. Cause I mean,
same goes for all animals. I think like if you find the right habitat year after year, they're going to find deer, elk, javelina. Like, I mean, come on, you find javelina on the same hillside almost every year,
every
right?
Year. Yeah.
Why? Because that hillside has everything that they're looking for.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Until that habitat changes. And when it does, that's when you stop seeing them there.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you watch stuff flower, you know. I mean, I watch coos deer go insane nuts over, you know, yucca blooms. And you can literally just watch them get gnawed off on a mountain range as they move. You know, you can almost tell. I mean, I've got to where I can walk in, especially on like that early season where everything's blooming up. I mean, I can walk in, put glass up, and I can see where they've eaten them blooms off another 200 yards from, you know, a week previous and go, yep, we need to concentrate glassing right here because they're going to be in here feeding. Yeah, so I could see that. That makes sense.
So you got a good story you want to share with us real quick at the end and finish this podcast up?
Well, so... I don't know if I got a good personal story. So I just took I mean, you've probably seen it on Facebook. I haven't posted it up, but so do you know Ryan Kinnear?
I'm sorry, Ryan?
Ryan Kinnear. He's a quadriplegic guy I take out every year.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I've seen that. The name didn't click, but yes, I've seen that.
Yeah, so he just smashed a buck, was it 2 days ago or so? You know, and he's the guy's done quite a bit, you know, for what he deals with day in, day out. And I have to admit, man, hunting the last, gosh, I don't know, 3 or 4 years that I've hunted him, he killed a buck last year, got a buck this year. You know, I would say hunting this guy has taught me so much. You know, getting him out and watching what he has to go through just to be able to get out to a hunting area. And even me with the guiding, I've gotten better hunting him. I've gotten better in the business because of the hunting I've done with him. Because, you know, you never take into account. I mean, I grew up in Arizona. I've hunted Arizona my whole life. And then I went back east and hunted, and I felt it was fairly easy to harvest. I won't say fairly easy to kill a big buck because, you know, I really didn't look at hunting that way growing up because we just harvest everything to eat. But the guys made my prep work and the logistics and what I, you know, in the country I hunt, I've had to pay so much more close mind because of having the opportunity to hunt with him. And he's made me a lot more successful and he's given me a lot more drive and ambition to do things. But I have to tell you, man, we hunted him this year. We had a big buck killed out from underneath us. We were hunting him on an alfalfa field, a giant buck. And then and it's kind of crazy watching this guy, and I hope you don't beat me up over it. So obviously he can move his right thumb a little bit, he can turn his head a little bit, you know, but the guy is extremely accurate. The guy's hunting with a 338 lapel, and I mean he can shoot out 1,200 yards with this rifle. And the very first hunt I had him on a coos deer hunt. I slept him in a cargo trailer, and you know, we were pushing through some country that I honestly, in my opinion, and I'm sure you would be the same, I thought, you know, when he called me up, he goes, you know, how hard is it to get around? I'm like, oh yeah, it's easy. I mean, you just drive right here to a windmill and drive right here to a spot to glass this ridge. And I never conceptualized that, you know, the man has no control over his neck. A majority of us has no control of it. And when I was taking him into that country, John, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to kill this guy. I'm going to end up killing this guy. I ended up having to sit in the back of a truck and hold his head as we were traversing terrain. And he was a champ, man. He hunted it for 4 or 5 days, 3 or 4 days, actually, I think. And I had a coos deer, a glass tip of coos deer at, I think it was 900 yards or 800 yards. And he goes, well, I'll shoot it. And I said, well, hell, there's no way you could. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to let you take that shot. Being on the conservative side, you know, in the guide mentality, and I wasn't guiding him. I was just, you know, taking him out. And I was like, yeah, man, that's just too far. I mean, that's too risky of a shot. And the deer ended up moving off. And at the end of the hunt, he's like, you know, I think I could have made that shot. And I was like, well, there's a lot of people that think that they can make it, but that's a pretty difficult shot, you know? And it was at that time that I realized we picked a rock on the last day. And he goes, hey, I just want to see if I could have killed that deer. And I was like, okay. So I ranged a rock out there at 900 something yards, and there was a little split in it. And the rock was probably 2 foot by 3 foot. And he goes, I'm going to shoot the middle of that crack. And he shot that rifle and busted the rock. I mean, he put it right in the crack, right in the middle. And then I felt like shit for not letting him shoot because I didn't truly know his capability. So the next year we take him out, we get him a mule deer tag, and he, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm calling buddies of mine that have, you know, fields and people I knew growing up, and I get him out on a field, and we get this forked horn out there, and I range this forked horn. It's 967 yards, and he's like, I can kill him. I was like, okay, well, we're doing math because it's in a pivoted field, and we're doing math to make sure. I mean, Ryan's a smart guy. He's really good with numbers. I like to think that I'm smart and fairly decent with numbers. And Nate Grimm was there with us. And we're doing the math. all three of us are doing the math to make sure on the shot when he shoots it, it's going to clear the pivot. We're not going to put a hole in a pivot. And I think we had it all down. You know, I don't think we had matching numbers, but I think we were all within consensus that we were going to clear the pivot by at least probably right close to a foot. So he ends up shooting, and you know, the guy's like a bench rest shooter, you know, because the only thing that moves on him is he either moves the chair with his right thumb, or he's got, you know, his rifle's kind of got like this gun turret shoulder system that straps on. So his breathing may move it a tad bit, but not much. But he shoots and he misses the first shot. He shot out in front of him. Second shot, he hits the deer in the neck and dumps him. But we get this year, he's never seen, except for one time on a water hole I put him, he's never seen a real big buck. Well, this buck comes out, and I mean, I heard a shot from another hunter. I had Ryan on the deer. It was 900 yards. And Ryan's on him. He's like, "You want me to shoot?" And I was like, "Don't shoot." I said, "I got to make sure that you're not, this guy shot this buck out from underneath us, but I don't want you shooting his buck. I got to make sure." And I'm looking at the guy. I got the guy glassed up, and I'm looking at the deer, and I'm like, and I'm sitting here thinking, and I mean, this deer was up for 5 minutes. And I'm like, I think he may have shot a different deer, and he's looking at this deer, but I don't know. So I was like, well, and Ryan's chomping at the bit. "You want me to shoot? You want me to shoot?" And I'm like, "Don't shoot," you know? And I said, "This is the deal." I said, "If that deer turns around, he walks out into this field," I said, "you're going to shoot him." I said, "Because that guy's had ample opportunity to shoot him. And if he did hit that deer, he should have shot him again to put him down." So, you know, I'll have a little bit to go off of if that is in fact the deer and the guy tries to get crazy. You know, I can at least use that we were, you know, what we thought had happened may not have been necessarily what it was, but he should have shot the deer and put him down. But the deer, we eventually see that deer go down. So, you know, Ryan was a little heartbroken. We went out the next day and we had about 160-inch 4x4 come out in the field. And Ryan's getting in on him. And Ryan's an extremely technical guy. If you've never talked to him or you don't know him, he's got a Kestrel system. I mean, everything. I mean, overthinks everything. And we get out there and we can't get his Kestrel to program in with his dad's rangefinder. So we could never get a dope for this buck. And he gave us two or three short window opportunities to take the shot. We just couldn't get the Kestrel to plug out a dope for the rifle. So this deer ended up, you know, going. And the next day, you know, we get back out to the field. Ryan has wrote it, you know, his dad has wrote down, they've done the dope. They've got a manual dope sheet, and then they got the Kestrel, and Ryan, you know, shoots this buck, and he hit him a little far back and put another shot in him and dumped him. And this was the case, you know, he'd missed the first deer, and he goes, "I don't understand why, you know, I miss these deers I make a bad shot on the first shot every year, you know?" And he goes, I do all my sight in on a cold bore shot. And I'm like, "Listen, buddy," he's like, I said, "it's adrenaline. You know,
yep. and it's excitement of it all.
And he just,
you're pulling it exactly, or whatever. Somehow.
I mean, he gets just so excited to the point of almost blacking out, you know, when he shoots these deer. But I would say that was probably be my story, man. It's just getting to hunt with that guy. And
that's awesome.
And he's taught me a lot, man. He's made my guiding business better. He's made me a better hunter. And I always look forward and clear the date to get him out on a deer hunt.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I actually had, we had a guy, that was paralyzed from the, I think it was from the waist down, or might've been even the chest down. I can't remember, but I only had him for 3 days, and we had a really big buck shot out from underneath us too. We called him Spike. He had 9 main beams, and he was still in velvet.
Oh, wow.
Just crazy gnarly, you know, crap coming out from every direction. Awesome buck. We just could not get him. And this guy could shoot really well too. He was confident shooting a 6.5 Creedmoor. He was confident shooting out to like 700 yards. And he, after the morning hunt, you know, I wanted to see him shoot. We took him out and he was pounding rocks, you know, too, out 700 yards or whatever. I had to leave after the morning hunt. So I left him with the, you know, with my guys, and they got on a buck, and it just took too long for this, to get him set up every time. And for some reason, these bucks, they just would not stay where they, you know.
Yeah.
We couldn't, and it was just, I felt so bad because he worked really hard, and I know the guys worked really hard too, just to get him a buck, and it didn't end up getting him one. But it was cool. It was cool to see that.
Yeah, it's a fun hunt. I mean, we just you learn to take, you know, coming from the guiding side, which I know you can, you know, relate. You just normally, when you're talking to a client and you're trying to wage out what their capabilities are, it's usually so minuscule to what it is that is kind of your norm or your system. And it's just having to deal with those little inconsistencies that they do a little bit different, or they just don't do it all that you do in order to achieve success. And then just hunting with Ryan, and you know, he had a guy that I hunted here on an archery hunt that was blind. Mm-hmm. That, you know, he high fived awesome. And he's like, "Hey, dude, you got to call Eddie, man. He'll get you on a deer." And I'm like, "You know, I'm calling blind." I'm like, "Listen, man, life's tough, buddy. And you know, just because we killed a deer doesn't mean that I can take out just anybody and get it done. I mean, let's slow step into this process, and I don't want to get people's hopes up, you know." But, you know, that's just how Ryan is. But it's just, you know, getting in and hunting with him, man, it's just an awesome thing to watch, and the amount of prep work that goes into it. I mean, I thought I had a ton of prep work when I bring a client in. But, man, the prep work he does daily just to get out and shoot is just phenomenal.
Well, awesome, man. That's a great story. Thanks for all the information. Thanks for coming on. We'll definitely keep in touch.
Yeah.
You know, as the season progresses here, I'd like to see what you guys end up doing. And I know we keep talking about it, but one of these days,
have to get together and do some hunting, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. For sure. Well, good luck, man, in your hunts. Hopefully you get it done early and get up there on the res and get after some giants.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Yeah, all right, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, bud.
Talk to you later.